Coming up next, please join us for Real Israel Talk Radio. This is episode 146.
Shalom, I'm Avi Ben Mordechai. This is Real Israel Talk Radio. Previously, we were listening to California attorney Ivor Bai speak about American law and jurisprudence and how it often relates to what is found written in the Bible. Attorney Ivor Bai has been active in courtroom trials and criminal law since graduating law school in the late 1970s. Ivor grew up in Spokane, Washington, and has a current practice in Victorville, California, which is located outside of Los Angeles in the high desert of Southern California in the USA. On our last program, Attorney Ivor Bai was discussing how the meaning of words plays an important role in the legal profession. However, what sets this attorney apart from many others in that profession is that over the past many decades, he has remained a devoted supporter of biblical law and justice, and how it relates to each of us in everyday life. Let us now continue with where we left off on our last program. Here is California attorney Ivor Bai.
If you want to be like Yeshua, then you got to start out on the same path that he's walking in. Because if you are obeying everything else, but you are saying, well, Torah doesn't apply to me because I'm a Gentile, then you're not walking in his way. You cannot be like Jesus because his code of conduct was Torah. And if we disregard Torah, you can't be like Jesus. A big concept nowadays is mentors. Let's call him our mentor with a capital M. He's a mentor. This is the way you do it. I've given you my word. Look at it. Study it. Just ingest it. Take it. And the word for, with Torah, Strong says there's two words. One says it comes from this next word, and then this word says this comes from this word. And you look it up, it gives the definition of an archer missing the mark. It's teaching, instruction. You can study that thing with the most powerful microscope in the world or magnifying glass, and you are not going to find even a hint of law in the root. And so in any word, you must get to the root and realize that the meaning of the root goes all the way up to the plant. Just to clarify, I gave an example, because we do that in English. Okay, let's take the word beautiful. Where does that come from? Then there's beautify, beautician, beautification, and then you finally get to beauty, because the root is beauty. And so everything in the root word is obviously, in this word, part of everything else. A beautician, a beauty shop, it all means the same thing. This is all we're doing in Hebrew. John 3:16, where Jesus says, whosoever believeth in me should not perish. Well, okay, and the church has used that to say all you have to do is believe. Well, how do we know how a person believes? There are two kinds of evidence in court, two major parts. There's direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, okay? And if anybody's watched any television, circumstantial evidence always seems to indicate a weaker case.
A weaker case.
A weaker case. Hmm. Well, it's only circumstantial evidence. And I explained to all my juries the difference, because my job is to educate them in the law as to the law that they have received. Mm-hmm. And I say direct evidence is very simple. It is any evidence perceived by the witness with one of his five senses. He saw something, he heard something, he smelled something, he tasted something, he felt something. That is direct evidence. I touched this, it was wet. I heard a gunshot. That's all direct evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, circumstantial evidence is you look at the surrounding circumstances. We use circumstantial evidence in just about every crime in California because crime of robbery, somebody comes in and they steal the they take the property from another by force or threat of force with the intent to steal. We can't read his mind. How do we know he intended to steal?
We don't know what the person's intent was.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Except by circumstantial evidence. Hmm. And this is the way that we handle it. Well, Mr. Clerk, what happened? Well, this guy came in and pointed a gun at me. Do you see him in court today? Yeah, it's that guy sitting over there at the table. Hmm. May the record reflect that he's pointed to the defendant. So reflected. And then what did he do? He said, give me your money. Were you afraid? Yes. And then what happened? I gave him the money and he ran out. Did you ever get the money back?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay, well, you didn't get it back. So that indicates he had the intent to steal it.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Now, whosoever believeth him should not perish.
Mm.
How do we know somebody believes?
By their works, I would think.
By their actions.
Mm.
Okay, you look up believeth in the Strong's Concordance, G4100, G standing for Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 4100. And it gives pistuo, and then it says from G4102. Okay, to have faith, and you look at that. Well, it says this came from another word. So you learn this definition, then you go to 4102 and see this, pistis, and it's from Greek 3982.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get there. And it says persuasion, credence, etc. Then you go to 3982. And it's pico, and it says a primary verb. Boom, you've got the root.
It's the root. It's the root that goes and it nourishes or brings its energy, if you wish, to the plant.
Yeah, but one of the root meanings is obey. Can you imagine how different traditional Christian theology would be if they had translated whosoever obeyeth him?
Oh, wow. You could do that because of the root.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Now, when Yeshua was asked by the rich young ruler, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What did Yeshua do? He quoted the commandments 6, 7, 8, 9, 5, and then Leviticus 19, 18. And the young man said, well, I've done that from my youth up.
Hmm.
And then Yeshua said, if you want to be perfect, then sell all you have and give to the poor. And he went away sad because he had lots of wealth. However, I looked up the word perfect, and in the Greek, it means when you are mature, when you are experienced. So the key word to that whole story is young. He was a young ruler.
As opposed to a mature,
exactly,
complete person.
Because I have not met very many, if any, mature young people, you know?
I don't think that's possible, is it?
and of course then, uh-huh. So it's like, and he says, well, I've done that. And then again, Luke 10 with the lawyer, it's what you do. I love the Lord your God and love your neighbor, okay? Now, primary verb to convince, but then it's agree, assure, believe, have confidence, be content, make friend.
Make a friend.
Make friend, obey.
Yeah.
I am your friend. That is the root of believeth.
Oh, okay, that's the root to the word believe, which is related to faith, which is all that.
Yeah.
It's friendship, really.
It is friendship because when you are friends, you don't want to do anything to hurt your friend.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. No. Well, let's see. Was that prophesied? Deuteronomy 18:15. Yehovah thy Elohim will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren, like unto me, unto him ye shall hearken. Deuteronomy 18:18. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee. I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him, And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken, hear and obey my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him.
Mm-hmm.
This is all very consistent.
Mm.
That's the prophecy. Yeshua just fulfilled that prophecy perfectly. And nobody believed him. Because now we say, well, no, it doesn't apply to us because we're of the seed of Abraham.
I want to go back to this idea of you will not tempt Jehovah your Elohim, or as the Lord your God, or however you're going to say that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to tempt him. So you said a couple of things that were interesting about how, even how Hasatan, the serpent, remember how he did that with Yeshua in the 40 days mm-hmm. of his trial in the wilderness?
Yeah.
What was he doing? What was he up to with that word, tempt? And Yeshua said, you will not tempt Jehovah. What's the story there?
Well, the like every other word, it can mean tempt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because what was Satan trying to do? He was trying to change his mind to worship him. You know, if you remember...
Matthew 4, yeah.
Okay, he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and when the tempter came to him, he said, if thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. Deuteronomy 8:3. Then the devil taketh him up into a holy city, and setteth him on a pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto him, if thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down. Now he's quoting scripture, for it is written, he uh-huh. shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone.
Yeah, but here's this tempting idea, going back to the definitions you were, used, the legal definition, okay? He's questioning, scrutinizing, investigating, looking for ways to reinterpret ideas, concepts. And he quotes from Psalm 91. That's the quote.
Yeah, 11,
but 11, he 12. But he leaves out the part about the way. He leaves one line out of that quote.
Mm-hmm.
He's twisting something, and he leaves it out. You can go back to the psalm and look. I mean, it's Psalm 91.
Yeah, I mean, I've got it written here.
Let's go back there and take a quick look at that.
11 and 12.
Okay. Notice what's missing. Is this what bad lawyers do in court? Is this what witnesses do? Is this what the defense will do? Is this what people do in the flesh? We twist. We contort things. We try to redefine ideas. Isn't that what we do?
Well, a lawyer that does that is risking being disbarred.
Okay.
Because you cannot mislead the court, period. If you do, then you can be disbarred.
Well, that doesn't seem to be the case today, but okay.
Oh, yeah, I know.
All right, let's go back to the Psalm. Okay. So Psalm 91, okay?
Yeah, 11 and 12.
Okay.
He shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. Thou shalt tread upon the lion. This is verse 13.
Yeah.
And adder and the young lion and the dragon.
Yeah. But notice where he says, keep you or safeguard you in all your ways.
Mm-hmm.
That is not in his words. No, look at, compare
right,
that.
Right.
Compare it.
Yeah. Lest thou dash thy foot against a stone.
He skips the part about to safeguard you in all your ways.
Right.
What's he doing?
He was still trying to gain followers. And he knew, he saw the danger.
Permit me to give you what I see as that answer and see what you get your response on this.
Okay.
Yeshua's ways, what he was going to do was the way of the cross, was the way of the execution stake.
Mm-hmm.
He had to take it all the way to his death and resurrection. By not quoting that part, he was essentially deflecting away from Yeshua's stated mission. That was his calling. The way was to the way of the execution stake.
Well, obviously, Satan didn't want that to happen. But I think that he was really pushing to have Christ sin. And the only way that Yeshua has the credentials of being Messiah is he was sinless. He obeyed Torah perfectly. And so all HaSatan had to do was get him to just break it a little. The root of wicked is wick, and a wick of a candle is twisted. And so this is what he's doing. He's trying to make it palatable, hoping, I think, that he wouldn't remember that phrase that he left out. If he could get Yeshua to violate the least commandment, then he could no longer qualify as the Messiah.
Okay, fair enough. You've made a really good a really good case here, and I'll give you an opportunity as a lawyer for your closing argument.
Well,
you're going to need that. But I would love you to speak to the problem that we are facing today, particularly in the United States of America. Now, other world, other nations and everything have their own issues, but we all kind of know what's going on, at least at this recording, in Washington, with all of the news going on there and the politics. Talk to us a little bit about the founding of America and its biblical basis, because you are a firm believer that, in fact, the United States of America was founded on this biblical stuff, even though these guys were deists. Can you speak to some of this, please?
What a lot of people didn't realize about the American Revolution is that it was a religious war, because the United States, if a man wanted to be a minister, he had to go to England to seminary, because the King George III would not seminaries, okay, period. But it's very evident all in the founding of this country how God was there. At one point during the American Revolution, there were too many miracles happening that even in England, in government papers during the war, they discovered a memo from one leader to another. What is going on over in the colonies? It is like Jesus Christ himself is fighting against us. Okay?
Really?
Yes.
Really.
It's my understanding that on the day that the American Revolution started, April 19, 1775, that the colonies were in prayer and fasting. And the, and they did not want war. I mean, it was the night before when Paul Revere, going through, the British are coming, the British are coming. It was very clear right from the beginning that God was involved. And some of the miracles, there's one. Washington, with his troops, were on Long Island. And they were surrounded by the British. The British knew they were there, and the men of war circled the island completely. And George Washington looked at that, and it was at night, so he figured, okay, they're going to come in the morning. And George Washington knelt down and prayed.
Wow.
He prayed. And then, according to an historian named Fisk, an unexpected heavy fog settled on that. Couldn't even believe it. Well, Washington, because the fog was so heavy, they ended up getting every boat on the island, and that would, he had ordered that, I think, before he prayed, and they were able to load all the men on the boats, all the cannons and the military equipment, all on the boats, and then they left the island, and they could see the shadows of the men of war, but not a horse whinnied. No noise whatsoever.
Wow.
And when they got off, I mean, the next morning, the British soldiers came onto the island. Where'd they go? We knew they were...
We knew they were there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the peace treaty that mm-hmm. ended the American Revolution, it's called mm-hmm. the Treaty of Paris, 1783,
mm-hmm.
and the very first phrase says, "In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity." Okay? What other religion has a most holy and undivided Trinity? Now, this was signed by the three American delegates, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and John Adams. Now, don't forget, the British signed it also. That's the way it was. Now, a lot of times you can go into a library and take that book out, American Founding Documents, and you turn to the Treaty of Paris, 1783, and you see dot, dot, dot. They eliminated. Because
they eliminated what?
The phrase, "In the name of the most holy and undivided."
Oh, really? Oh, oh that. Yeah. Oh, that's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
But see, at least they were honest enough to put dot, dot, dot in there to indicate that there was something there, but we deleted it because it was irrelevant.
Oh, it's not irrelevant.
No. Well, yeah. But if you were a godless person, it's irrelevant. And so anyway... Then let me just skip ahead.
Mm-hmm,
there
mm-hmm.
is, in the 1880s, Congress passed a law, there's nothing new under the sun, passed a law regarding immigration that nobody could bring into this country an immigrant for purposes of labor or service. Okay? Church of the Holy Trinity in New York. Church of the Holy Trinity was on the grounds of the Twin Towers. It's still there. Okay.
On the grounds there, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because the church owned it.
Mm-hmm.
The church
mm-hmm.
owned, but the church
mm-hmm.
is still there.
Mm.
And so Church of the Holy Trinity hired a British pastor to be their pastor. And they were immediately taken to court and to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, as they do, they first read the law. And it's exactly what I said. No person... And that means real or artificial, like a corporation,
mm-hmm.
can
mm-hmm.
bring in to this country an immigrant for mm-hmm. service or labor. So the church hired a British pastor to be their pastor. And the Supreme Court of the United States said the Church of the Holy Trinity is clearly in violation of this law.
Because they brought this British pastor in.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
To perform the service of being their pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court then said, but we are a religious people.
Mm.
We have always been a religious people. And then cited 87 precedents establishing that fact.
Mm.
Now, words change in their meanings. The word religion to us nowadays is not what it meant to the founding fathers.
Mm.
And we know that because... If you get a copy of first edition of Noah Webster's dictionary, American Dictionary, and I've got a copy,
mm-hmm.
it defines the word religion. He has five different definitions. The first three are very, very lengthy, but each one of those three we would call Christian fundamentalists nowadays.
That's how they would have understood the term.
Correct.
Religion.
Correct.
Is Christian fundamentalism.
Correct. It meant Christianity.
Mm.
It wasn't even fundamentalism, it was Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the fourth one is just sort of a generic religion mm-hmm. in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one, almost one line, said that it's, you know, just the worship of any deity. So that is what it means in the First Amendment, where Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It means Christianity.
We're listening to Ivor Bai, California attorney at criminal law, who is speaking about biblical jurisprudence and how it not only relates in the courtroom, but also how it relates to everyday American law. We'll return for the second half of our conversation in just a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Avi Ben-Mordechai, and this is Real Israel Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the second half of Real Israel Talk Radio. This is episode 146.
Hi, this is Avi Ben-Mordechai. Welcome back to the second half of Real Israel Talk Radio. I'm talking with Ivor Bai, an attorney at criminal law in Southern California in the USA. Ivor is speaking with me about biblical jurisprudence and how it relates not only in the courtroom, but also how it relates to the history of America and American law. Join me now for the second half of my conversation with attorney Ivor Bai.
Words change in their meanings. The word religion to us nowadays is not what it meant to the founding fathers.
Correct. Religion is Christian fundamentalism.
Correct. It meant Christianity. Hmm. It wasn't even fundamentalism, it was Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that is what it means in the First Amendment, where Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It means Christianity. That's what they meant when they put that in there.
I see.
How do I know? The U.S. Supreme Court said that the word, well, they're talking about it's a religious nation, 87 precedents, and then at one point they start using the word Christian in the same context, but they make a very, very interesting statement, and that is the First Amendment, U.S. Supreme Court. The First Amendment applies only to protect Christianity. It does not protect the followers of Muhammad or the Dalai Lama. Okay? Because we're a Christian nation. And they made that very clear. But see, that was the culture. And now this is the mess. Because nowadays, well, and almost since then, every man does that which is right in his own eyes, because there is no longer a king in the United States. Every war has a motto, right? Okay, remember Pearl Harbor, okay? Mm-hmm. Remember the Maine. Remember Twin Towers. Well, the war's motto in the American Revolution, no king but King Jesus.
Oh, serious?
Yes.
Huh.
That was the motto.
That was the remembrance phrase.
That's right, yes. No king but King Jesus. We don't want King George III. No king but King Jesus. And you can then go to George Washington's in first inaugural address. And he starts out, and it's just all written, because back then they didn't give it verbally, they just wrote it out and he turned it into the Congress.
Wow.
In it, he was talking about it and he said, it would be peculiarly improper at this point not to mention how we are here because of God. Something like that. He gave everything, all the glory to God. God has done that. He made us a nation. Then he goes to affairs of state. How God did it. It's almost like a magnet. And then a third time, went back to God and finished up with God. John Quincy Adams, in his 4th of July address, July 4th, 1837, he said that the birthday of this country, July 4th, 1837, is indissolubly locked or linked to the birth of the Savior.
Interesting.
They were Christians. Now, you mentioned that they were deists. Okay, the word deism has also changed in meaning. And with Benjamin Franklin, I was reading his autobiography, and he said, I'm a deist. Okay, well, that's pretty clear, right? Well, no, you got to get the context. Because above that, he said, I attend, and he may name different denominations, and I don't remember, but it would be like, I attend the Baptist church, I attend the Congregational church, I attend the Lutheran church, I attend this church. I attend all of these. I'm not a member of any of them. I'm a deist. Well, that is clearly not what deism is today. Because every church that he named were Christian churches. Are you familiar with the clockwork theory of the universe? God created everything, and then he stepped back and said, okay, you're on your own, and he started, pushed the button.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And it started.
Okay.
So, this is the clockwork theory of the universe. God does not interfere. You're on your own. And that is the modern definition of deism. Benjamin Franklin, in his most famous speech, was the Constitutional Convention, 1787. He was about 90 years old. He wanted to speak. Two men lifted him up and held him up, just like Aaron and Hur with Moses. And he addressed the delegates there to George Washington. And he said, sir, I have lived a long time. And the longer I live, the more I know God governs in the affairs of men. That's not a deist, because you're on your own, I'm not going to get involved.
That doesn't work.
It doesn't work. But then he continues, he said, because they were bogged down. This is about 6 weeks into the convention, and they were getting bogged down. They were fighting all over the place. And he said, remember, during the war, we met in this very room and prayed. And our invisible friend answered our prayers. How have we so soon forgotten him? And he's quoting other things. If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his eye, how can a nation rise without his assistance? And then he quotes Psalm 127, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. This is Benjamin Franklin. It's all in the notes of that Constitutional Convention. And so he made a motion to take a break because they needed to have a prayer meeting. Well, it failed because they didn't have the money to hire a pastor. However, they still took a break, and they all prayed, and there was this pastor, I think Reverend Dufray, or a French name, a very famous painting hanging in the Capitol of the preacher there with his robes and all the men of the Constitutional Convention in prayer. That's a painting hanging in the Capitol building of the United States of America.
In Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C. Okay? Now, because it was there, when they finished, then all of a sudden everything was taken care of, and boom, they were back, and they passed the Constitution. They drew it up, all agreed on it. There is so much evidence of the Christian roots of this country. You know, again, even 1892, U.S. Supreme Court case. In 1809, there was a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case where this guy was convicted of blasphemy in this country, in the state of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. When we first got started, we had, our law was English common law, you know, because we were an English colony and everybody was English. Technically, the American Revolution was the first civil war on this continent. But the state started passing laws, but the common law was still used. And this guy was found guilty of blaspheming because he was saying Jesus Christ is a fake, the Bible's a bunch of fairy tales, da-da-da-da-da-da. He was found guilty, and he was fined, and he appealed it up to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And the Supreme Court affirmed his conviction and affirmed his punishment. And in the opinion, because they write an opinion as to why, the judge said, an attack on Jesus Christ is an attack on the foundation of the United States of America. Okay?
Wow.
This is law.
Wow.
This is opinion from the Supreme Court. And he affirmed the penalty. And let me tell you that. The penalty, 90 days in jail. Okay, no big deal. He fined him, he confirmed the fine, 1809, $500.
That would be unbelievable today.
Almost $1 million today, if everything doubles after, 20 years. You know, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4, 8, 16, 30. I mean, it goes up very quickly, because this is over 200 years ago. Our fabric was Christian. Whenever a new town was built, the first building to go up was the church, right in the middle of the town, and they built around it. George Washington built many of them with his own money. Even when he was president, he always had a standing appointment at 7 o'clock every night with the Lord in his study. And even when the cabinet was there, he would excuse himself. He had to go in for an hour and just pray. And he said, "You don't interrupt me unless it's really, really important." But that was what he practiced. That's what he did. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You cannot control learned people. If people can think for themselves and are intelligent, then you can't control them. And that is why the school system in this country, and probably in every other country, is really dumbing us down, except maybe China and Japan, because they're in school 6 days a week. And now we're learning nothing in our school. A couple of weeks ago, one of Linda's grandsons came over, 15 years old, and I mentioned something about Paul Revere, and I said, "You know who Paul Revere is, don't you?" And he's 15-year-old. "Well, I've heard of him." "What?" When I was in public school, first grade, when we lived in Idaho, every morning the teacher would start out with reading a chapter out of the Bible, then pledge the flag, and then she'd give the second grade an assignment, then come over and teach the first. Well, and that was the whole year. Well, the next year we moved back into Spokane, public school, and the teacher, Mrs. Cook, said, she stressed just about all the time, "We were founded by Christians. We are a Christian nation." And she had a lot of books for the class to read. I mean, it was just that.
Ivor, what has happened since those late 1700s, early 1800s? What's happened to America? Are we a constitutional nation now?
Well, getting back to the American Revolution, the leaders, the real leaders of the American Revolution were the pastors of the churches. Nowadays, pastors don't want to get involved in politics. "Oh, no, that's dirty. We don't do that." So Edmund Burke, who was in the parliament during the American Revolution in England, he was a supporter of the colonies. And he said that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. This is why we are in a mess today, because good people, the Christians, do nothing. In fact, I was just checking the internet, and in California in 2006, and I picked that year for a particular reason, we had 36 million people in here in this state. But one in five, 20%, identified themselves as born-again Christians. So you figure 20% of 36 is 7.2 million people in California identify themselves as Christians. 7.2 million. If every one of those Christians voted their Bible, we would be completely controlled by Canada.
By constitutional law.
Yeah. The Democrats would not have a hold. But that's not the sad part. The sad part is, of those 7.2 million, 40 million didn't vote, 15 million were not registered to vote. I mean, all that is required for evil to triumph is going to be laid right at the door of the church. I've been saying that for 50 years. When America falls. When America falls.
Not if.
Not if. When America falls, the blame will be laid at the church door, because Christians didn't do anything. It was their fault. God has given us a blessing in this country. And like the children of Israel came to view the manna, they loathed the manna. They loathe the provision of God. You don't have to go very far at all in reading Founding Fathers' writings about how thankful we are for God giving us. Under our Constitution, we have the right to choose our government. That is the good news. The bad news is we get the government we deserve. And so everybody now, it's a little like shutting the barn door after the horse is out, because you didn't do what you were supposed to. You didn't appreciate.
You didn't vote. You didn't pray.
Yeah.
You didn't make your voice heard. That's we're not talking about pulling up swords and guns and going into revolution. That's not what we're... I mean, I don't see Yeshua saying that that's what we're supposed to be doing.
No, no.
But I do see that we have, within our rights as citizens, to peacefully protest,
mm-hmm.
to say, hey, look, this. What are you doing? What's going on here? You know, and voting your Bible, voting according to your conscience and things like this. Yeah. But we don't do any of that. We let it go.
Yeah.
But I know in Australia, I'm a citizen of Australia, by law, I have to vote.
Yeah.
By law, I have to vote, or I get fined. That's actually kind of a good thing in a way. I mean, I don't, you know, necessarily want to vote in every situation, but by law, they require that.
Right.
So what if they required that here among every citizen?
Of course, now they are wanting non-citizens to vote, because that's yeah. that's the only way that
right.
the liberals can win.
Ah.
The only thing that is going to bring America back to God is when the Christians, the people who claim to be God's children, get on their knees and start praying, Father, we need a revival. We need a revival. We have had at least three major revivals in this country. There was the First Great Awakening
mm-hmm.
before we became a country, the Second Great Awakening, and then in 1909, we had a revival in this country. And the statistics were 10% of the population became Christians. It was making the front pages of newspapers. And things started changing, because God is the only one that can change a heart. It's our fault, because we have loathed the provisions of God.
We're in a bad way right now.
Oh, yeah.
In America.
Yeah.
And you think that this place is gonna fall.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done nothing. The horse is out of the barn.
That's right.
And we've allowed for all kinds of crazy things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And of anything nowadays, it's...
No. Mm-hmm. The Constitution's mm-hmm. purpose,
mm-hmm.
and nobody seems to remember that
mm-hmm.
because they don't read it. The Constitution's purpose is to guard this country against the problem, the evil of big government. That's the purpose. Because in the Constitution, the states agreed to relinquish some of their rights to the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the 10th Amendment also incorporates that, even though it's in the body of the Constitution, that the federal government cannot act beyond what we have given you authority. That we have relinquished our rights, we've delegated our rights to you. Now, somebody a few years ago said, if we went back to just the limits of the Constitution, mm-hmm. we would eliminate 75% of the federal government.
Wow.
75%. Obviously, big government is a flexible term, because a government governing 13 states would not work for a government governing 50 states.
Like we have now.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can grow proportionately. Back when Jefferson became governor of Virginia, he wanted the Torah to be the criminal law code in Virginia. Okay, well, that says a lot. As I've told you, my favorite topic is just talking about the Torah and talking about
mm-hmm.
the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
My second favorite is the Christian history of this country. It mm-hmm. is replete with God being all over. But you know, knowledge is power. Christians don't have that knowledge, so they're powerless.
There's a lot to say, a lot to talk about, okay? You have been practicing criminal law.
Sure.
You were a deputy district attorney in Southern California for some time. You have spent countless hours in the courtroom talking with judges and, you know, and prosecuting. You've done a lot of that stuff,
yes,
right?
Yes.
You see lots of correlations between your legal work and what's written in the biblical narratives.
Yes, because we were founded upon Christianity, upon the Bible, John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams, was the sixth president of the United States, and he's the only man that after the presidency, he was elected to Congress. Mm-hmm. And so he was in the House of Representatives, and that's always a two-year cycle. Every year when he was the congressman, he would submit a bill to be passed for the freedom of the slaves. Free the black slaves. Mm-hmm. And every year, the Congress just defeated it. And I think in 1848, somebody asked him, don't you get a little discouraged that you've done this every session and they vote it down? And basically he said, well, God is telling me I've got to do this. The results are not my problem. You know, I just have to obey doing what he tells me to do. And that's all we have to do. That if we obey, then it's up to him. The results are up to him. Hmm. And that takes a lot of pressure off of us as long as we do what he wants us to do.
I would like you now to give your closing argument to us.
My contention has been for a long time that Christians do not pay attention to what Jesus says. I mean, in Matthew 5:17, he gives us a commandment. Think not that I've come to destroy the Torah or the prophets. Think not. Well, what do we say? Oh, Torah doesn't apply to us. The church doesn't pay attention to what Jesus says. Mm-hmm. And of course, they don't pay attention to the Torah. Mm-hmm. The Jews don't pay attention to the Torah. And they are going more by the oral Torah. And so nobody is paying attention to what God is saying. I contend we need to get back to the Word, take it literally. Study is hard work. I was actually in school, either before I became a lawyer or even after. I took classes. 23 years I was in the classroom. And some of it was after law school because I had a hunger to learn. And we should always want to learn. But all of this goes to the fact that I'm learning the Bible, I see things in the Bible, and we've got to just start obeying the Bible. My prayer has been for years, Father, don't be easy on me. Don't let me slide on anything. I mean, I step out just a little, you get me back into line. And I don't want to be whipped into line. I want just a nudge. I don't want to get so far off that you've got to punish me. I want to obey you the way you want to be obeyed. You know, I study the New Testament, study the Old Testament, and I would urge people, get into your Bibles, study, but do like you would learn any other subject in school with your textbook. Start at page one.
Which is not the Gospel of John.
Correct.
I would say it's Genesis 1:1, if you ask me.
That's right.
You know?
It is.
Yeah.
And so do that. Start there. Study it. Learn it. And, you know, it is work. But once you start getting into it, you're going to find out how much enjoyment studying and learning does.
Thanks, Ivor.
Thank you.
And, folks, thanks for listening today. Again, your email address, please.
eberbye@gmail.com.
Thanks, Ivor.
Thank you.
We've been listening to an interview that I conducted with California attorney Ivor Bye, who has a specialty in American law and jurisprudence, and how it often relates to what is found written in the biblical texts of what is called the Hebrew Torah. Attorney Ivor Bye has been active in courtroom trials and criminal law since graduating law school in the late 1970s and has a current practice in Victorville, California, which is located outside of Los Angeles in the high desert of Southern California in the USA. Over the past many decades, Ivor has remained an active and devoted supporter of biblical law and justice, and he often speaks about how it all relates to each of us in everyday life. I'm Avi Ben-Mordechai. This is Real Israel Talk Radio.